Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. Listener, welcome to yet another episode of the Gravity Commons Podcast. I'm so glad that you're not tired of this yet.
It's relentless, though. It is an onslaught, a weekly onslaught of podcasts.
You've got you, and I appreciate your perseverance. This is episode 392, the Gravity episode of Gravity Commons Podcast. Isn't that fun? 392.
We used to record these in the same room together, next to a standing desk right here in my office. Remember that?
I do. That was the initial setup.
And then I think COVID led us to just be virtual. And then we're this works too.
This actually works fine. And then one of us doesn't have to leave our house, which I hate doing. I hate leaving my house.
I know you do. You're going to have to leave your house later today to meet with me. Are you going to be okay with that?
I'm girding up my loins for it. I'll be okay. I'm going to get there eventually. Hey, Matt, have you ever heard of, this is a concept I just learned about today, Maycember?
I saw somebody say Maycember on Facebook this morning.
Yeah, and I was like, wait, what's that? That's like a combination of May and December. And what it is, it refers to the fact that for parents, their May calendar is even busier than their December calendar.
Because
they've got, you know, recitals, they've got, you know, back to, they've got like, you know, they've got dance recitals, they've got, you know, dress rehearsals for the dance recitals, they've got exams. They've got graduations to go to.
Mother's Day.
Your conferences. Mother's Day is part of it.
Yard work.
Field trips.
Hysterectomies. There's just all kinds of things happening in May.
Yeah, I think you're supposed to schedule those in May. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just wondered if you had heard of that, or if you feel you still got kids like in school. I don't know if you feel that Maycember, just the exhaustion of it.
Heck yes, I do. But
yeah.
So we live in the Midwest, Indiana, and May is one of the best months of the year. Mm. It's warm and the mosquitoes aren't out yet. And it's like sunshine after, you know, several years of darkness and gloom. Yeah. It feels like, you know, the busyness of May is compensated by kind of the warmth and the sunshine and everything coming alive. But just last night, we did our discipleships in the street class at 7 p.m. Eastern. And my son had his end-of-the-year orchestra concert.
Yeah.
And it went from 7 to 9:30 last night. And I had to come late, and I was scared I was going to miss my son's performance. And I got there at 8:30, and I hadn't missed any of his performance because the other two or three orchestras had played, and they gave out awards to them. So, you know, my 13-year-old was delighted to be sitting there for her brother's concert for 2.5 hours. But like I slid in for an hour, boom, boom, boom. I cried a little bit because it got a little emotional, a little beautiful. But yeah, like that's one of a myriad things that we're doing, you know?
Tons of stuff.
And it's crazy for our kids too. Like my son has all these finals he's taking. He took a final a couple days ago of a class he didn't even take this year. He just decided I'm going to try to shoot for this AP final. So I get in the States, if you get a certain score on an AP test, you can get exempt from college, taking the college course. So he's trying to get a certain score to become exempt for a college class. So he's doing extra studying, and it's just he's looking for a job, and it's bonkers, man.
It is bonkers. Probably people are planning for trips like summer vacations and stuff. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, but there's also like I don't know. There's the end of the road, like the end of a school year, feels like such a relief to kids.
Yeah.
Remember how great summer break was?
Oh, I loved summer break. I loved the last day of school.
It was like, it literally was like getting out of prison.
Yeah.
You know, I'm free.
Yeah.
You'd walk out and you'd stare up at the sunshine, you know, and you'd be like, this is what it means to be a free man.
Yes. Finally. Yeah.
You know, you get on the bus.
Yeah.
Go home. I just remember it was like a Rumspringa, you know, I would like eat everything in the house, play video games until 1 a.m. Yeah. It was great.
It was. It was so fun. I remember just, you know, planning on just hanging out with my friends. You know, we just like, what are we going to do? And we would just, you know, we just go do stuff, obviously in between summer jobs and stuff. But
yeah,
even for me though, like towards the end of my high school career, my summer job was lifeguard. So even that felt like, summertime. Even when I was working, I was out in the sunshine.
I have a question. Lake,
you know?
I have a question. So,
yeah.
It's no secret, Ben, that the star at the center of solar system, there it is, the sun is like your mortal enemy.
Yeah, it's true.
How did you in your Northern European porcelain skin handle being a lifeguard?
I feel like I handled it just fine when I was a kid. Maybe that's what happened to me, you know? Too much time in the sun. I became allergic to it.
My body
shriveled up.
Now, like, Ben's pretty equanimous. Like, you know, he's pretty even keel. Like, even when he's stressed out, you really can't tell because he keeps it all stuffed and bottled inside. But the times I've seen you the most grumpy is when you are outside in the sun.
Yeah.
And you have to be there.
Yeah. It's tough. It's tough. Yeah. There's something about it that just sort of, you know, I don't know if I got bit by a vampire when I was a kid, but like there's something about it that just saps all my energy. It's hot. Like I really just like feel it. It just like wears me out.
Yeah.
Really. It's really difficult.
That's why you are a self-avowed avid indoorsman.
Avid indoorsman. You know, I think part of it, I'm actually visiting an allergist this month.
Good.
Because part of it is I do have myriad allergies.
You really
and
do.
I think that increases my discomfort with being outside. Trouble is I'm allergic to like inside stuff too, like dust and stuff. But yeah, it's, I'm going to see if anything can be done. I may have told this story before, but a few years ago, I went to an allergist. Have I told this story? You know the story? A few years ago, I went to, listener, if you've heard this story before, you can forward 30 seconds. But a few years ago, I went to an allergist just to get tested. You know how they do the skin prick test? They put little... on your back. Mm-hmm. They put all the allergens and they see which ones react, you know, on your back. And so I got all the little, they poked me several times. I imagine that's what it's like to get a tattoo. Mm-hmm. But they poked me on my back several times and I just sat there, you know, for like 10 minutes waiting for my back to bloom. And the doctor came back in and his first words out of his mouth were, "Wow, you lit up like a Christmas tree." So anyway, that confirmed, I was like, oh. I must really be allergic to a lot of things. So anyway, we'll see. Maybe something can be done and I'll be able to enjoy the sunshine like a normal person.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Just shoot you up with a bunch of antihistamines.
Yes.
Intravenous, right in the neck.
That is, I don't know. I don't know how it works, but hopefully they'll have something for me that'll help.
Yeah. You know who probably doesn't take intravenous histamines in the neck is our guest today.
Yes.
Dr. Diane Langberg. Yes. By the way, listener, this conversation has a sensitive topics. So we're going to be talking about sexual abuse and rape. They're mentioned in this podcast. So, you know, take care of yourself as you listen. But we're chatting with Diane, who is coming back to the podcast. She's an internationally recognized psychologist with more than 50 years of experience. And she chairs the advisory board of the American Association of Christian Counselors until 2021 and co-founded the Global Trauma Recovery Institute, which trains therapists to assist trauma victims across the world. She's the founder of Langberg, Monroe & Associates, which provides counseling services in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania, and consults with Christian organizations around the world. She's the author of 7 books, including A Redeeming Power, and her books have been translated into 10 languages. She joins us today to talk about her latest book.
Go choked up about.
Sorry,
talking about this latest book.
Her latest book
is building. What's your latest book, Matt?
Do you have a drum roll?
Yeah. Oh.
Just hit a random button. Let's see if it works.
Oh no, that wasn't it. No, that's drum roll. I've got no. Oh, I just have that.
All right, that's good. Her latest book.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead. What's your latest book, Matt?
When the Church Harms God's People, Becoming Faith Communities That Resist Abuse, Pursue Truth, and Care for the Wounded. Listener, if you ever wondered whether or not we produce this podcast, the answer is no. But Diane was a great interview, and we're happy to bring this to you. Dr. Diane Lainberg, welcome back to the Gravity Commons podcast.
It's good to be back.
We've had you on before, and we talked then about power in the church, and it's good to have you back to talk about similar things because they continue to be important and current with what we need to live as redemptive and healthy people in the church. I wonder, by way of starting our conversation today, what keeps you interested in these questions about power and the misuse of power?
Well, it has a lot to do with the people that I sit with. Weeping people, frightened people, people who believe lies about themselves. And 99% of the people I see are church people.
Yeah.
And most of them come about wounds in so-called Christian families or churches or organizations that label themselves as Christian, which I think is supposed to mean Christ-like.
Yeah.
And often does not. Mm. And I think that we have missed that, a lot of us. But I know something about how many and how much that happens because people knock on the door to deal with those areas and who have been crushed and trashed by it. And they're people precious to God. So I've learned a lot about deceptive leaders, people with power. You know, when we spoke before, I was speaking about power. Now I'm speaking about the damage of power.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, which really is a grievous thing and really does damage to the name of our Lord. And it's things that God hates. And many of us have not dragged those things to the light, but have in fact covered them up because we're doing a good thing for God, which is full of cancer, basically. And we're not dealing with the sickness at all. So we cover up what God hates in order to preserve what we call his work. And so it's that work that in many ways keeps me going. We weren't wanting to hear from people who've been wounded. Also wanting to hear and hearing from churches that say we need help, which years ago that didn't happen.
Right. Yeah.
So there's changes there, which bring me joy, churches actually realize they've done a lot of harm and want to be truly Christ-like in their relationships, their teaching, and everything else.
I wonder if we could talk about that for just a second, because, you know, most churches don't consciously choose to be abusive, right? And yet so many people are harmed in this well-meaning faith community. Like, my guess is all of us on this podcast have been harmed. And so can you just talk a bit about why that is? Why do our churches cause harm despite our best intentions?
Well, we not only can cause it, we cover it up when it happens. And we think, or at least people have often said this, that they are protecting God's work. Mm-hmm. But that's like saying, I have somebody that I know and love, and they have just found out they have cancer. And because I love them, I'm not going to tell them. I'm not going to take them to treatment. I'm not going to do anything because it will upset them. And they will be harmed emotionally and whatever if they know the truth. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're protecting cancer in the body of Christ. And we think we're doing it for God's sake.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's even told, like, don't say something, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's threatened and told, yeah.
Yes, yeah. You're hurting God to speak the truth.
Right.
Which makes me scratch my head a little bit since he is the God of truth, but.
Right.
Yes. Well, this book, we'll get to it in a bit. This book is about how to become a community that's resistant to abuse, or sometimes we talk on this podcast about being allergic. So there's an immune system that begins to surround and neutralize abusive agents, right?
Yes. But
before we get there, you explore in this book a bit of some of the external forces outside the church or outside people that individuals that shape harmful and abusive leaders and systems. Would you name maybe one or two of those for us and why you think they're so significant?
So you mean the things that keep people protecting the system more than the people?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, number one, they're taught every Sunday and more that it's God's work. And God's work needs protection. And so if you raise up something that points to cancer, the response is it can't be true because we've been working God's work and we're protecting it. And they protect it again by the sickness. And I don't know if people have encountered this, but I've encountered it in individuals. You know, we're a family, so the fact that three of us got sexually abused shouldn't be spoken of because it'll break up the family. Or, you know, I myself won't tell something, even though I know it probably means I have cancer. But I'm not going to tell anybody because they'll be upset. You know, and so those kinds of things happen in organizations, not in just families or individuals. And we protect, thinking we're protecting something God loves, which it is, but he loves truth, justice, and all of those other things that we're ignoring.
It also seems like not only are they protecting, but there's also this weird privacy thing that's just for the leaders to know or something like that. Do you find that in the people that you talk to as well?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, there have been many cases that I'm sure you're familiar with where the leader has been abusing women for decades.
Yeah.
And other people knew it. The leaders knew it. But nobody said anything because he's a godly man and he loves God and our church is growing and we don't want to interfere with that. Mm-hmm. And so it is taken on by those in leadership who have the power to tell others to keep their mouth shut because you don't want to hurt the church, do you? Mm-hmm. In the meantime, in some examples, you're talking about many, many, many women. Not like one or two even, which would be enough. But tons, and the money comes in, and the fame is there, and the pastor's great and important, and everything else, and look what we're doing for God. Mm-hmm. And it's all full of the cancer of sin that not only is in there, but is growing because of our refusal to look at it and get treatment for it.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing. more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation. Let's get back to the show.
The three of us on this call are all pastors of one sort or another. And one of the things I think that's like a learning, it's like a the edge of our learning that's related to abuse and all of these things that you're talking about is the topic of trauma. And so we've had to learn a lot about trauma, how it works in our lives, how it works in other people's lives, to be able to kind of minister more effectively. And I wonder if you can just let us know from your perspective, what are some ways that churches can become more trauma sensitive, more trauma responsive, more trauma informed, to be able to meet more adequately the pastoral needs of people?
Well, I think the first thing they have to do is accept the fact that it's in their pews. Mm-hmm. It didn't necessarily happen there.
Right.
But if you looked at the statistics of sexual abuse, rape, domestic violence, I mean, people who've been in war, whatever, there's all kinds of things that cause trauma in human beings. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they're never measured because, you know, I came to Jesus and I'm supposed to be fine. And that's what's taught. You know, you got rescued. But if, you know, that was a, let's say, a physical thing, you know, a truck ran over both your legs, mm-hmm. you can love Jesus all you want to, but your legs aren't going to work. Mm-hmm. And they're going to cause you sickness and they're going to cause you pain and everything else. Yeah. And we want to erase all of that and yeah. say it isn't true. Yeah. And so we don't talk about it. If we hear about it, we deny it. Or we have some sort of simplistic answer, you know, just have faith in God and he'll help you. Mm-hmm. And we don't enter into yeah. what's happened yeah. and the sickness of it mm-hmm. and the damage it's done. Yeah. And so people come and sit in our pews with all of that in them and no light, no truth, no love is given. No invitation to speak truth is given. And we call that God's church. Mm.
So I hear you saying that just the acknowledgement that trauma exists and that you're not a bad Christian if you still have it. even I've been coming to church for years, or I've been a Christian for years, and it's like it's normal that you still have some trauma from an abusive experience or, a traumatic accident or, you know, whatever else, but like, that's just normal. And we can acknowledge that. And just the willingness to wade into the messiness of it, is maybe a first step for a lot of us, just to say that that's going to do a lot of healing work, just to say that it exists and it's okay.
And I believe you.
Yeah. And I believe you. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
And when you look back just at the life of Jesus when he was here on the earth, I mean, think of the sin and suffering that he absorbed just by talking to people.
Yeah.
And he didn't silence them. Mm-hmm. He met with them.
Right.
He walked with them.
Yeah.
And that's who we're called to look like.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I was chatting with a friend about their time with their in-laws over the Easter holiday. And their in-laws were talking about some national policies, political policies that they thought were good. And my friend was saying, this is actually harmful for me. This is going to do damage to me. And what hurt wasn't the fact that their in-laws disagreed. What hurt was this person felt unseen and invalidated because they never reflected back the truth that this is harmful for me. And what I hear you saying, Diane, is that like there's such a pastoral necessity to see and resonate with pain and to tell the truth about it in a way that helps us feel connected and seen and validated. Am I hearing you right?
Yes. And if you stop and listen very carefully to your own words, you are describing Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
He does all those things. He did all those things in the flesh.
Yeah.
So when we don't, we are not like him.
Yes.
No matter how freely we use his name.
Yeah. This is one of the ways that I think love works as a power. The power of love does this kind of resonating, attuning, connecting.
Yes.
Work.
Yes. Well, you think if you're a parent, you think about the first time one of your little children fell and scratched up their knee.
Yeah.
What did you do? You ran to them. You got down on the floor with them. You held them. You helped them get healing for it. That's what it's supposed to look like.
Yeah. Well, when you put it like that.
That was pretty blunt.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think all of us agree with that. And then all of us have either been in systems or been maybe a part of systems, meaning like working in systems that actually work to sort of normalize abuse or can deceive us about abuse. Could you talk a bit about how the culture we live in can normalize harm and or blind us to things that are wrong? How does that work? Why does that happen?
Well, I think we have taken the word abuse and sort of interpreted it as somebody made a mistake. Mm-hmm. They didn't really mean it. Which, of course, is supposed, I mean, even if they ran over you with a truck and they didn't mean to, however it hurts, it's not supposed to hurt as bad as it would have if it really happened. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah. We don't want the truth. And on one level, that's very understandable. We are creatures made by God to know him, to be like him, to be with him. And all of these things are not that. And we don't want to believe that. But he has told us they would not be like that until he returns. And that our call is to accept that as truth, no matter how ugly it is. And in those places, be like him. We just want to make it go away.
Yeah.
He didn't make it go away. It's still here.
Yeah.
So is he. But he calls us who name his name to enter into those sufferings just as he did. Not run from them, not erase them, not say the person is crazy, they made that up. None of those things came from him. And we are doing it to protect ourselves and our systems rather than the sheep.
I think that that is a tactic that often organizations and systems use, is they communicate to the person who like brings up the abuse, brings up the whatever happened, and then it's almost like an attack on their mental health. You are crazy.
Drop the almost.
Yeah. Yes. Which messes with people.
It does more damage on top of damage.
Yes. It's hard enough for someone to actually come forth with truth and share their story. And then if they're ignored or told to be quiet and then also told you're crazy, that's a lot of damage.
When I first started, which was many decades ago, a woman came to see me, and there was no such thing as trauma at that time. It wasn't a diagnostic category in psychology. It wasn't whatever. And certainly there was no such thing as sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And she came to see me. She was clearly terrified and said at some point in one of our early sessions, my father used to do weird things to me. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what she was talking about. Again, PTSD had not even happened yet. It wasn't anything discussed in graduate school, things like that. And so I did what I do, which is to say, if you want to tell me about that, I'd like to understand what you mean. Well, she did. I mean, this was a hideous abuse case where she was sold as a young girl, all kinds of things. So for whatever reason, God decided to start me with the whole thing in my face, as opposed to just a bit here and a bit there. But nobody had believed her.
Yeah.
And I chose to. And she was my teacher. She was my teacher.
Diane, I have a question, and this is a bit of a rabbit trail, but this is now the third or fourth time you've mentioned believing people who talk about abuse or harm. And I wonder if you could speak to the objection or the defense that's often I know some church leaders who are chronically anxious about false allegations, right? And they work overtime to make sure everybody knows that we have to keep guard about being falsely accused. Could you talk maybe a bit extemporaneously here about how prevalent are false allegations? Is this something we really need to be that concerned about? What's the hazard of believing people? Is there a hazard to believing people when they say, hey, I was harmed in such and such way?
Well, first of all, I have been doing this work for 50 plus years. I don't know if it's 52, 54, whatever. I quit counting. I have encountered false charges twice.
Wow.
And they were done by people who were full of hatred and wanting to do damage to someone they didn't like, they thought had hurt them in other ways, whatever. And they were people with a cancer in them, you know. And I've heard some really out there stories, but always in the work, things have been eventually shown or pointed to, or somebody else has said, yes, I was there too. I've heard things I found unimaginable, and they turned out to be true. We do that, number one, because we don't know what to do if it is true, that's true. And we do that because we think it's going to hurt the name of Christ. But if dealing with sin hurts the name of Christ, he was in trouble a whole lot of long time ago. You know, this isn't going to do it.
Yeah.
And he calls us to truth. And he doesn't just say nice truth. And we don't want to believe that leaders that we have revered or learned from or who have been kind to us or anything else would ever do anything to harm anybody. But we're talking about human beings in places of power who want to protect themselves, which I get. But unfortunately, they have often done so by getting rid of truth and teaching lies. And you know enough about all the news about different large churches and pastors who have been having sex with women for years, and nobody has said anything. And it's not like they're saying now, well, it really didn't happen. They're not saying that anymore in those places. But they covered it up for decades because it would hurt the work of Christ.
Yeah.
It would hurt his church. As opposed to sin and lying about it is what hurts his church.
So what do we do?
Like, I'm afraid you're dead. I mean,
looking, I mean, part of me is like, okay, looking forward, like, you've observed a lot. Like, what helps create a culture where we're not immune to abuse, where we can actually make some changes, do something so that these repeated abuse things don't happen anymore?
Well, the don't happen ever anymore is heaven. So I can't make that happen.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. But we can certainly change greatly what's going on and not. And there is some of that going on. I mean, there are trainings and things now available. But again, it's very obvious in recent times with these churches that have been uncovered, basically, for ongoing abuse by lead pastors, famous ones, loved ones, and nobody did anything about it because either they decided it wasn't true because he would never do anything like that, or if we tell, then we'll destroy God's work, which is very hard on my brain to try and figure that one out. Yeah. So I think that we have to I think the church has to go down on her face because we have covered up things that God, I mean, the church exists because God taught us about the church. Families exist for the same reason, but so do sinners.
Yeah.
And we have harmed the things that he has created and that were never meant to be treated like that.
Yeah.
And we think we're going to help them by covering it up. But if you cover up cancer, what happens? Yeah. It grows. And if you keep doing that, eventually the person will die.
I hear you kind of saying, make sure there's no cover up. Make sure that you're listening to people, that you're believing people, that you're doing active listening so that they feel heard and seen and known and loved in that. Go to trainings because there's trainings in different places.
Invite them into your church trainings.
Yeah. Yeah. Invite. Yeah. Have people. It seems like also, maybe the structure of when something happens, when there is some sort of abuse in a church or an organization, that there's a structure that can handle that. There's an HR, there's like, it's not that there's just one person in charge, but there has to be shared leadership, shared responsibility, yes. Shared, you know, that type of thing. We haven't really talked about that, but that seems like another practical thing. I mean, I worked in an organization that didn't even have an HR system. And I was like, this is not okay. If there's a problem, who are we supposed to go to? Oh, the person doing that? Like, no, that's like, it's not going to work out, right? And so making sure that these structures are in place to also help when someone has the courage to come forward.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And you can bring in training from other places. You can bring in training for different groups. You know, here's how to deal with things with children, with women and men, whatever. That's increasing slowly, but it's increasing.
We use Safe Church at our church. I don't know if you've heard of Safe Church trainings.
Yeah, we do too.
And I'll be honest that it's a hassle.
Yeah.
It's a hassle. Mm-hmm. Like, Ben, on my list of things to talk to you about later is the Safe Church audit that we've got to do.
Yes.
In the next 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. I don't have time for that. That doesn't feel like it's pressing or urgent or it's not something that I feel like, you know, it's not like, you know, no one cares if I've done the Safe Church audit at 10:30 a.m. on Sunday, but they do care if I've prepped a sermon or not. You know, that's how it feels in the local church sort of machine, yeah. Right? Yeah. But I'm also just convicted of like, this is why churches choose not to become places where abuse is rare. Because it never feels like that could happen here, right. Or that we need to do this now. And so part of it is just like becoming resilient with the hassle of doing these trainings.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, you've probably encountered, worked with women who've lived with abusive men, domestic violence stuff. And it's a long time before she comes forward for exactly the same reasons. You know, it's going to mess up her world. Yeah. So she puts up with the abuse. Then she lets people know, and then she's got all this other stuff to deal with.
Yeah.
So it's almost easier to do nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yes. If you do something that requires more somethings, yeah. It's easy not to do that.
Yeah.
And it's expensive.
Yes,
like,
it is.
To do a background check on someone, for everybody to like watch the videos for Safe Church, like all of those things cost money and have to be part of your budget as well. Mm-hmm. And it's worth it. It's totally worth it. But you have to be intentional in that way.
Yes, you do, but it's for the lambs.
Yeah.
That's who Jesus loves.
Yeah. I'm going to, when it comes time for me to re-up my Safe Church certification, I'm going to have your voice in my head, Diane, saying it's for the lambs. So it's going to help me.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
That's a good point to make that, again, this is maybe one of the ways that churches unintentionally don't put in place. Like they do, we would never want to harm anybody, but it is, there are these sort of like very mundane reasons why it's difficult to put into place the means by which we can, maybe be less able to harm people, right? It's just, it's just a hassle. It doesn't feel urgent until it's a crisis. And it just takes some intentionality.
You're also saying something incredible to victims in the pew who were not abused at the church, but have an abuse history because of some person or a father or a teacher, whatever. And they hear you saying this matters. And they hear you saying it's wrong. And they hear you saying we want to be sure that we don't have that here. Somebody who grew up sexually abused for years has never heard anything like that. Yes. And you're not going to know, probably for a good long time, that they're listening to you because they don't want to bring it to the light because they're scared. Yeah. But you're providing them with information that says this matters to us. Yeah. It's wrong. We want it not to happen here.
That's a good point because I do a training for all of my volunteers for kids and students. Every year there is let me remind you of some things. And one of the things I say, I think the new volunteers are a little bit like mouth wide open. They can't believe I said it, but I do publicly say in front of everybody, hey, if I hear, like if something comes like to my attention that someone is getting hurt in some way, I will not hesitate even a millisecond to call DHS. And I want leaders to know that. Yes. I want kids to know that because I think it's important. Because I think a lot of times, people think, oh, it's got to be really bad. No. If I hear one thing, I'm not going to hesitate. They're on my phone. Like I literally have DHS as a phone number in my phone because I want people to be protected.
Yeah. Well, and you think of what hearing that does to someone who was sexually abused by father, uncle, grandfather, all of her life, who went off to college. Somebody taught her about Christ. She became a Christian, but all that's tucked away. And nobody, when she comes to church, she's never heard anybody even say that it exists. So she's not going to tell anybody.
Right.
Number one, they're not going to believe her. Number two, if they do, they're going to say it's her fault, which that has happened to many, of course. So to hear something like that turns a light on and gives hope. And you might not see the fruit of that for a long time in that she might not come walking up to you right after you say that,
right.
But you've given a gift to victims in the room, particularly those who have no one else.
I wonder, Diane, as we maybe come to a close here, if you can talk a little bit about forgiveness and repentance. These are good things that we're all called to as Christians, right?
Yes.
We're all called to forgive as God has forgiven us. We're called to repent of our sins. I wonder if you can, but it's complicated because these words, ideas have been deployed kind of in a weaponized way,
yes,
in ways that are very unhelpful. And so I wonder if you can talk a bit about how forgiveness and repentance fit into dealing with abuse and becoming communities that are resistant to abuse.
Yes, I can certainly say a few things. There's also a whole section on that in the book.
Great. Yes.
And so there's more than I can say. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to deal with it because it says it happened. And so we try to make it as short as possible. And I think that Christendom has, for a number of years, long before all this stuff started surfacing, has made forgiveness cheap. You know, your husband hit you a few times, you know, talk to him about it, forgive him, he cries, everything's fine. That's not what forgiveness looks like. It certainly doesn't look like in terms of Christ. I mean, he got dead forgiving us. And so I think there has to be a lot different teaching about forgiveness and sin from the pulpits. It's not something that just pushes a button and makes it okay. And if someone really has done those things, one of the reasons you know that forgiveness is something that can be done and wisely done is when you hear from that person themselves, not, oh, I'm so sorry, but I want to know what that did to you. I hurt you terribly. And I don't even know how much. But can we get a safe party to sit with us and I listen to how I've done that to you? It's not just an, oh, I'm so sorry and I'll never do it again. Yeah. And we have cheapened it in the church. Yes. And it's magic words that make everything go back to normal, which weren't even normal to begin with.
Good point.
So I think some of that is teaching from pulpits.
Yes.
You know, here's things we hear about, things we love God to do for us, mm-hmm. and things we are failing on miserably. Yes. She said subtly.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I think I see that. I see that everywhere, that the ideas of repentance and forgiveness being cheapened in order to do the same thing that we started this whole conversation talking about, which is, I just want this to go away.
Yes,
I want things to go back to normal. Nice. And so, hey, if he says he's sorry and you can just forgive him, like, can we put this behind us? Right? It has to go a lot deeper than that.
I have a story that I have told a million times that has to do with repentance. When years ago, I think I was still in graduate school, so that's decades ago. But anyway, we went to a prison and we were going through the prison and they were talking to us about the different people they were. And we walked by the prison of a man. He was a very big man and he was in there by himself, which tells us something. And the group moved on and I stood there and he came over to the bars to me and he said, I want to tell you something. And I'm thinking, oh boy, what have I just done? And I said, okay. And he said, you listen to me. He had sexually abused a number of children. And he said, you need to tell them, never let me out. I will do it again. And he knew what was in him. And he acknowledged what was in him. And he had so far had nothing change that, make it go away, whatever, which is what everybody wants to believe. And I don't know what his history was and all those things because I got called back to the group. But I'll never forget it. That don't let me out. I will do it again. Yeah. We do not make room for that possibility.
Right.
And part of it is we just want the other person to feel better. Well, I don't think Jesus did the things he did to make us feel better. Yeah. He wants truth. He wants us to be like him. And we are falling short on those things. We're protecting institutions instead of people. Yeah. We're protecting all kinds of things instead of human beings that he loves. And we think it's quick. You know, if you cry and say you're sorry, it's done. Mm-hmm. Except it isn't. You don't abuse a child. You don't wake up one day and just decide to abuse a child. It's not like that.
No.
It's been there. The odds are it's happened many times before. It's been practiced, and it's practiced in here.
Yeah.
We cheapen it.
Yeah. There's something. People
get hurt.
There's something even commendable or virtuous about someone whose desires are so warped telling the truth about that.
Yes.
And wanting to protect other people from that.
Yes.
Than it is for someone who tacitly acknowledges wrong and wants to quickly get past it in a way that doesn't bring justice.
Yes, absolutely.
The book, again, is called When the Church Harms God's People, Becoming Faith Communities That Resist Abuse, Pursue Truth, and Care for the Wounded. Dr. Langberg, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. It's always a privilege.
You know, I was thinking about Jesus is the good shepherd, and he says, you know, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And I was thinking of that verse in particular in reference to my bemoaning the hassle of not becoming someone who understands what abuse is and how it works, but having to rewatch videos I watched a year ago or 2 years ago.
Yeah. I'm convicted. The safe church stuff.
Yeah, I'm convicted that to lay down my life looks like laying down my time and my money. Hmm. Like, what is our life if not our time, attention, mm-hmm. capital,
right.
affection, you know?
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's an impediment that lives in me that I didn't choose, that I need to face and reckon with. That part of being a good shepherd is to lay down my time. Mm-hmm. In ways that don't appeal to me, yeah. You know?
Yep. Yeah. I think of that as well. There's so many little, I'm even putting that in air quotes. Like there's so many little things like, you know, safe church trainings and things like that. But so many little things that I find myself conditioned to treat as little, right? That's why I put it in air quotes, listener, that are actually really big deals, but they don't seem to me like a big deal. And so there is this resistance built in to my body to doing them because it feels like I have more important things to do.
Another thing that Diane referenced early in our conversation, and I didn't return to it because we had some good momentum going, but she mentioned how often harm can be done despite our good intentions, right. or despite right. what we volitionally choose or are conscious of.
Yeah.
And I was reminded of this. I've referenced this book before. There's an incredible book by a sociologist named Heinrich called The Weirdest People in the World. And WEIRD is an acronym, Western, Educated, Industrial, Rich, Democratic. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about West, like the West. Mm-hmm. And he's saying how being weird, those things, change our psychology. Or we have a unique psychology that's informed and formed from those conditions, right? And so one of the studies he talked about is like, There was a scenario where two people were meeting and they put briefcases next to each other at a meeting and the briefcases were identical. And when one person got up to go, they grabbed the wrong briefcase and discovered it a day later and came back and returned the briefcase to swap it out. In the West, that's seen as an understandable gaffe, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't intend to steal your briefcase. Yeah. It was a mistake. And it's generally agreed upon in most social scenarios that that is an understandable mistake. And it's sort of excused, right? In non-weird cultures, that person stole the briefcase. Hmm. It's an offense that needs rectification somehow. The reason being is that in the West, we have a value of free will individualism. Meaning, as individuals, we should be primarily held responsible for those things that we choose consciously. Mm-hmm. And if we don't choose it consciously, we are less responsible. Right? And Heinrich was pointing out that that seems self-evident to us, but it is a fact. It is a feature of our psychology that it's not universal. And so in other cultures where free will individualism isn't baked into sort of the psychology, the cultural framework, it doesn't matter if you chose to do it or not. It doesn't matter if you knew you were doing it when you did it, right? That doesn't matter. And I was thinking about that in terms of, I've done this. I didn't mean to do that. I'm sorry you were hurt by that. Right? If I didn't mean to harm you, then you have no right to feel harmed.
Right.
Or you shouldn't feel as harmed as you seem.
This should make it 87% better.
Right. Right.
For you to know that I didn't mean that.
Right.
Paul and I were just talking recently about how, well, we were talking about like, we should write a book about parenting and like put all the lessons that like I feel like we've said to our kids over and over and over. And one of them would be a chapter on intent, action, and impact. And what we teach our kids is a lot of times we will say we're sorry as if like, I didn't mean to do that. And we're just really apologizing for our intent. Like we didn't have that in us to actually hurt you, right. They don't take responsibility for the action that actually happened, and they certainly don't take responsibility for the impact on the other person that your action had on them.
Yeah.
Really, in an apology, you need to repent of your intent, your action, and your impact, and take responsibility and say, tell me more. How did this impact you? I want to really show that you're caring about the other person. And that's kind of what I hear you saying, Matt, of man, in our culture, we don't do that.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there's almost like this gets back to maybe the cheap repentance that Diane was talking about, where if I can, I'm basically getting myself off the hook of action and impact. If my intention was not to hurt you, then I'm not culpable at all.
Right.
Rather than, I think sharing that you never intended to hurt someone, that can be an excuse that gets you off the hook.
Right.
That you think gets you off the hook. Or it can be an act of care that then is followed up with, oh, I had no idea. I didn't mean to do that. But please tell me how that impacted you. Please help me understand because I don't want to do that. So it's like sharing, I didn't mean to do that, is not as an excuse that gets me off the hook, but I didn't mean to do that as an invitation into help me not do it again, help me not do it again.
And there's a lot. Okay. So on one end then is I didn't mean it. So you shouldn't feel harmed.
Right.
And on the other end of maybe the spectrum is anything anybody says to me that harmed them, I have to feel guilty about and take responsibility for.
Right.
And I think that's what some people are scared of, right?
Yes.
Like if we begin to consider our impact as data that we have to pay attention to, then the cancel culture mob will come for me.
Yep.
Or people will weaponize that, right? Christy, when you shared about your kids, well, it took us 7 years to have kids. And so when you talk about having kids, that really harmed me because we were infertile. Right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that didn't happen, Christy, but that's an example of what I'm saying. And so I want to maybe just share a little bit of in between those two things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Because I don't know if we have much of an imagination for in between those two things. Recently a friend of mine told me that they found my personality, unintentionally manipulative. That I use my intellect and humor to control people. And that was devastating for me. Obviously, that's not what I want my intellect and humor to do. But I also felt like, gosh, if I don't have dad jokes, I don't know who I am. But I also felt like my humor and intellect are part of how God's give, what God's giving me to show up in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so I found myself saying to this person, if what you're saying is true, I don't know how to be present to you or with you in a way that's helpful for you or me. So I don't know how to be with you. I feel paralyzed, and I don't know how to be with you in a way that's good and helpful for you. And I, to me, that was my attempt to go somewhere between those two polarities of owning where I'm at, not gaslighting them that what they're saying isn't true, but also not becoming stupid and unfunny to fix the problem they say I cause. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You guys?
Yeah. I mean, I guess first, I hear and can see how that would be really hurtful to you. So I'm just going to name that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then the other piece of it is, it sounds to me like you didn't dismiss it. You didn't say like that there's never been a time that that's ever happened, that you've ever used that in your life to control. You didn't like deny that. You also didn't take full 100% like that's the only way I ever use my intellect in humor.
Yeah.
And so there was this, let me dig in here a little bit. Let me see, like, is there any truth that I need to kind of look at and kind of pull out and examine? And then you were just honest and vulnerable to say, like, hey, I'm processing this. I don't really know how to be with you because it feels like it needs to be all or nothing. I mean, you didn't say those words, but like, that's kind of what I hear you saying. And like, you're trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually said way more than what I'd shared. I mean, I did say, if you're right, then, and I don't know, if you're right, then I probably don't understand the extent to which this is happening. So we need to investigate this. Like, your charge needs to be taken seriously. Because if you're right, I'm doing unconscious or subconscious damage to people. And I don't want that. So let's get to the bottom of it. So yeah, I think any kind of allegation or charge like that needs to be sussed out, mm-hmm. right? I don't want to be unintentionally harming people.
Right.
I don't want that. I don't want that for any of my friends, but I really don't want that for me. So I think in addition to like, I don't know how to be with you, which was my just confession, mm-hmm. it also needs to be sussed out. What's the veracity here? What's the reality here? You know? And that's not something I felt competent to suss out. Mm-hmm. I can't evaluate that, you know? Maybe leaving that scenario and going to another way of like moving in between those two all or nothings is just to own, I didn't know that doing this or saying this would have that impact on you. And had I known that, it would have changed my willingness to do or say that.
Yeah.
And so I'm really glad you told me, and I'm sorry that what I did that to you. I'm sorry that what I said did that to you. And knowing this now, I think I have more data on how best to care for you and how best to love you. I'm trying to find language somewhere between, because I'll just say this, like transference, Google it, right? Mm-hmm. It's a real thing.
Yeah.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
Transference is when we've experienced harm or trauma or moral injury in one arena of our life. And then in a separate arena of our life, someone triggers or pings off of that harm, and yeah. we transfer the harm we experienced in arena A to arena B. Now, what I've learned personally is that in arena B, some people get my animosity that's disproportionate to the animosity they deserve because I'm bringing past hurts into a present situation and putting it into a present situation in a way that is disproportionate to the actual situation.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, everybody?
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate your honesty in that because I don't think people talk about it a lot.
Well, it's easier to talk about your own transference than it is to name somebody else's. Because when you're naming somebody else's, hey, I know you think my comment hurt you, but really, you've got a father wound.
Right.
And what you're doing right now is you're taking out your frustration and anger with your dad on me. That is gaslighting.
Right.
Right? A, like, I may be wrong. I actually may be the asshole. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And B, like, that doesn't care for that person.
Yeah.
What that does is you're trying to deflect the criticism that you're receiving and deny responsibility, which doesn't care for the person. It cares for you.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So talking about transference then needs to be something we do ourselves and then create an awareness where people can increasingly own and name and identify when that's happening for them.
Mm-hmm.
And as leaders, we have to lead the way in that, meaning we have to own when that happens to us.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that we may not know it in the moment. Like sometimes that takes reflection and really a lot of work. Like
And lots of therapy. Yeah. Oh, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I recently was in an argument with Paul and he used a specific word that was massively triggering from something else that has happened in my life.
Yeah.
And I was like, I mean, I went from 0 to 100 in like a millisecond.
Yes.
And what I think Paul was trying to communicate was not how I took it, because I took everything from this other situation and heaped it on him.
Imported
and was
it.
Like, yeah, you're saying this about, blah, 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 you know, whatever. And I had to come back. I didn't know it in the moment. I was like, why was I so angry at that moment of the discussion that we had? Mm-hmm. And then to come back to him and say, hey, when you actually use this specific word, it brought up all of this other stuff for me. And I'm working on that. But I also want you to be aware of that. Like, I understand you're not going to always remember, oh, don't use this specific word. But like, I'm sorry for my reaction. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to process and separate and untangle what our argument was about and all that happened in the past with this other person.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, one of your other options, Christy, would have been to say, you know, I know what you meant when you used that word. You were trying to hurt me. And so never use that word again because I know you're just trying to hurt me. Right.
Right.
So you're sort of, you know, trying to get inside somebody else's head, that kind of a thing. And so I've found I think that is really important to try to find language, right, that allows us to meet each other in these kinds of moments. One of the super basic things that I've found really helpful for me is just just on a tactical level. I can't remember. Some of this is boundaries language, and some of it I think comes from Brené Brown. But I've found really helpful for me when I feel agitated, upset, or sort of, you know, irritated, where I recognize something's happening here for me that I'm not in my right mind. If I can just stick to the script of when you blank, I felt blank because the story I tell myself is blank. If I can just say that, I just fill in those blanks, it's so helpful for me. To just be like, okay, there's meaning. I'm attaching meaning to your actions. What's that meaning? Mm-hmm. And then I'm owning my own response to it and checking it with you. You know, when I hear you say that word, Paul, I feel super angry because the story I tell myself is that you are doing X, Y, and Z, or you are wanting this or that.
Yeah.
And then that gives Paul a chance to say, oh my, I had no idea.
that word means that to you. I don't want to, you know, that kind of thing, rather than getting into this accusation game about.
And it's not even what we're really talking about.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, this is a bunny trail, right?
Yeah.
So,
but these complex networks of injuries and harms and past hurts, et cetera, mm-hmm. are always showing up in our relationships in local churches.
Yeah.
They just do. And the more access we can gain to them, the more we can normalize talking about it, the more we can identify and become conversant in our own patterns, the better we'll be at not only asking for what we need, right, but also not taking everybody's, this is a huge thing for me, not taking everybody's past hurts personally. Hmm. You know?
Yes.
Because if I'm able to not take somebody's harm, hurt, abuse, trauma that comes online personally, I'm able to own what I need to own.
Yes.
Because there's less at stake for me. Mm-hmm. Meaning, this isn't, maybe this isn't about me. So I can own what I need to own, but I can also not spend all my time trying to care for myself. Mm-hmm. Meaning, and we do have to care for ourselves, but what I mean is like defend, deflect, deny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is a hazard, I think, in pastoral ministry. Maybe, I know we're going pretty long here on this outro, but we've talked about this offline and maybe online, the three of us, and Ben, I know you and I have had conversations with others, that sometimes as pastors, there's moral injury in the job.
Yeah. There's a lot more transference, for example, that gets foisted upon somebody that's sort of a public leader.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember recently being in a conversation where somebody who I was pastorally responsible for asked me to share about some of the harm and abuse that I experienced. And when they asked me to share it, I knew that they were getting ready to not be like, resonate with me in that, thank me for sharing that, to care for me, but they were getting ready to argue with me about it.
Why it shouldn't have been a big deal to you or something.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I knew, like, it wasn't immediately clear to me, what do I owe you? Mm-hmm. What can I share that? I don't even think participating in some kind of conversation where you argue with me about whether or not I've actually been abused is good for you or me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
What's the cost of indulging this question? And what's the cost of refusing to answer this question? And is there a third option between the two? And I don't even know if so how I answer the question maybe isn't important here, but those kinds of situations are myriad in ministry. Mm. Where I don't know if I can trust you with me, but I also have a responsibility to you as a pastor to care for you.
Yeah.
And sometimes I don't know if I can care for you and not incur moral injury.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't know, that's just tricky.
Yeah.
Right? Do you guys understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Really hard.
It's really hard to know what to do.
You know, Christy, I know you've shared stories with us offline about in youth ministry with like parents who are like upset with how you're caring for their kids or don't understand what you're doing for their kids. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I want to help you here, but like, whew, you are attacking me and I don't know how much that I can take.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really hard.
It's really hard. So I don't know. I guess rather than like resolve all this or answer all these morally complicated questions, mm-hmm. I think what I want to commend is normalizing the conversation about them. That we don't have to center ourselves as victims, as pastors. Mm-hmm. I know you feel like this decision we made as a church hurt you. But let me tell you, I'm the real person who's hurting. You know, that's kind of gross. So there's a time and a place to actually have these conversations as church leaders, and we're choosing to make this a time and a place. Mm-hmm. But it is context dependent, right?
For sure, yeah. Yeah, there's even some risk in, I mean, there's a podcast and, you know, everybody's listening to this. So if we're gathered with a bunch of clergy, that's one context, right? But, you know, there's probably clergy listening to this and people who've been hurt by clergy listening to this. And so it impacts people in different ways.
Yeah.
For sure.
And, you know, one of the things that we share in common with those people is that we've all been congregants. Mm-hmm. The three of us, even though we're in church leadership now, we've been congregants.
Yeah.
And we've had complicated and unfortunate relationships with clergy too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's good conversation. It's good stuff to talk about and keep talking about. So,
well, I mean, we're kind of committed to doing that. I hope everybody's not tired of listening to this stuff. You know?
Yeah. We're not talking into the void, the digital void. Nobody's listening. Hopefully not.
Yeah.
We do get regular, we do appreciate, listener, your regular feedback, both in the Gravity community and via email, just about how the episodes that we're curating and here on this podcast are impacting you and how they're helpful for you or not. That's really helpful feedback for us. So keep it up. Join the Gravity community. Email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. And let's keep talking about these things.
Christy, before we go, we had a question in the comments, and I didn't know how to answer it. I wonder if you could help answer this question. The question was, what kind of overalls does Super Mario wear?
It's a deep question. Mm-hmm. What kind of overalls does Super Mario wear, Matt?
Denim.
That's cute one. I'll give you that one.
It does require a little bit of knowledge of video games.
Yeah, I know.
Video games, but
we see you, Gen X, out there. We see you, all the Gen X people that played Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah. All right. Well, see you guys next time.
Till next time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the start recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.